Hey, everybody. Welcome to Political Badger. I'm Jack Thompson. Today, we have a really special guest for you. He is the former Assistant Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan. He was previously Associate Editor and Columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He has written many books, including his most recent entitled How America Was Lost from 9/11 to the Police Warfare State. He writes frequently for his website, paulcraigroberts.org. I'm a huge fan of his work. If you don't read his articles, do yourself a favor and make his website a part of your daily routine. We are very excited to welcome Dr. Paul Craig Roberts to the show.
All right, so joining us now is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Dr. Roberts, thanks so much for coming on today.
I'm pleased to be with you, Jack.
I wanted to start off by talking a little about the economy. And since the 2008 crisis, it seems our government and the Fed's handling of the economy has really only gotten worse. Are you surprised that we've made it another 6 years without another crisis?
Yes, I am. And the reason we've made it is that, in my opinion, is that the government has all the markets rigged. And so when a crisis starts to show up, they intervene and stop it. And the question is, how long can they do that? And that's the unresolved question.
And so by rigging, you mean printing money, basically?
Well, that's part of the Fed's part of it. You know, the Fed has rigged the bond market by printing money to buy bonds, which keeps the prices high and interest rates low. And the Fed also has the bullion banks, its agents, rig the gold market so that the price of gold doesn't rise and put pressure on the dollar from quantitative easing. But the government also rigs the stock market. Anytime the stock market looks like a serious contraction, they step in, the plunge protection team, Treasury and the Fed step in and buy S&P futures.
Mm-hmm.
And if you buy the futures, that moves the market in the opposite direction from the fall. So they put out an endless stream of rigged numbers and optimistic spin. So they pretty much have the system rigged.
Do you feel the stock market is currently in a bubble?
Oh, yeah, sure, of course. You know, the dollar's in a bubble. The stock market's in a bubble. The bonds are in a bubble. Now, gold, they suppress. So it's actually suppressed, the price. But, you know, I saw a report just the other day that the largest purchases of stock for the last 6 years have been the corporations buying back their own stock.
Right.
Figure I saw was $4,140,000,000,000 that the corporations had spent buying their own stock. Now that, of course, decapitalizes them. You know, that is decapitalizing their market position. And so, how can the stock market be up for any real reason? The reason it's up is the companies are buying back their own stock and they're the biggest purchasers of equities. So, and some of these companies are actually borrowing money from banks in order to buy this stock. So their debt goes up, but not their investments to produce earnings to service the debt. So I would think the stock market is vastly overvalued.
Now, last time, you know, housing was the catalyst for the crisis. What do you see as a potential, you know, pin that could prick the next set of bubbles?
Well, it could be any number of things. I mean, housing, again, I think is about to go down. But I think the weakest link is the dollar, because it's hard for them to rig the value of the dollar. I mean, they can do it, but within limits, because they can get the Japanese central bank, the European central bank, to print those currencies in order to support the dollar.
Right.
Or they can have what they call currency swaps. You know, here's $100 billion, give us the equivalent in yen or euros. And then the government here can use the money to support the dollar. But I think the weak link is the dollar, and the policy of imposing sanctions tends to encourage people to get out of the dollar payment system. Mm-hmm. So we see that already happening now with Russia and China.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that were to accelerate and start moving quicker, then it's probably more pressure on the dollar than they could support. Or there could just be any kind of event that could happen. You know, they've got everybody now expecting war with Russia. You know, Russia is the new threat that they've created with propaganda, and Putin has been as unprovocative and reasonable as you could imagine. And but these Russian people in Ukraine, in the parts of Ukraine that are formerly part of Russia, are being slaughtered, and there could be rising pressure on the government from internally inside Russia to stop this.
Sure.
And so if that, you know, pressure gets strong, I mean, he can't rule without domestic support. So whereas he's trying to not give the Europeans any reason to support the American position by not being provocative, he could be forced into some kind of action. And, of course, if the Russian military go in, the Ukrainians would be almost instantly wiped out.
And but could you see Putin doing something like, you know, no longer using the dollar as you know, payment method and switching to...
Yeah, well, they're already doing that. That's what they're already doing. In fact, his economic advisor has stated publicly that the only way to bring down the United States is to organize a war against the dollar. So the Russians and the Chinese have signed that big energy deal, and
right.
No dollars. And now the Russian Central Bank is working with the Indian Central Bank to work out their trade, so there are no dollars. The BRICS, you know, the mm-hmm. five countries, Russia's one of those, they're forming up a bank between themselves that excludes dollars. So it's already beginning. And I think that the sanctions accelerate it, because what it shows everybody is that if you don't do what Washington tells you, they impose sanctions. They can't impose sanctions if you're not in the dollar payment system. So I think that it is moving forward.
So, you know, if things get bad, you're not looking for another 08-style crisis. You're looking for, you know, real collapse.
Well, it's a house of cards. The house of cards is larger now than in 08, because we've had the bond market push to unbelievable heights. I mean, you know, the real
right.
interest rates are negative. The real interest rates are negative. So if you buy a bond, you're actually losing.
And, right.
I mean, if they pay you a quarter of a percent or even 1 or 2%. I mean, the inflation is much higher than that. So you're not earning anything. So they got the prices get up so high. The stocks are unrealistic when there's no job growth, when increasingly the jobs are part-time,
mm-hmm.
benefits. I saw a report the other day from the Federal Reserve, and this was the most astonishing thing I've ever seen. It said that two-thirds of American households were unable to raise $400 cash.
Wow.
Two-thirds. The people said, well, we'd have to sell possessions, we'd have to borrow from family and friends. A few of them said there's still some room on the credit card. We could get some kind of cash advance. So that shows you there's no consumer economy. So if there's no consumer economy, there's nothing to drive the economy.
Right.
So it can't go anywhere. And what has been happening these years, people have been drawing down their savings in order to live. And as these savings evaporate, that ability evaporates with it. I saw another report that the average household wealth had declined by a third in the last few years. So it's not a situation that's realistic for an expanding or booming economy.
Right. Now, I've heard you say a lot that you don't buy the numbers that the government puts out. But are you surprised that we haven't seen more inflation to this point, given all the money printing?
Well, not the way they measure it. But you see, most of the money they've printed is locked up in the banking system because the banks are not lending it out. You know, the banks are in trouble themselves. And, of course, the people are so indebted from the credit boom earlier in this century, the one that began under Greenspan, that they really can't take on any debt. And the banks really can't afford to lend. They need the reserves because I don't think even the banks know what the consequences of the derivative exposures are. So cash is valuable. And so they have all these excess reserves with the Fed, and the Fed pays them interest on it. So I think that that's the main reason. The money simply has not got into the economy. Now, on the other hand, the way they measure inflation is a ruse. They've done two things. They took what they do. It used to be inflation was measured by a basket of goods
that right.
They said approximated consumer expenditures, and they were weighted by the size of the expenditure. And so if one of those prices in the basket went up, then the inflation index would rise by the weight of that element in the basket. Well, what they did, they said, well, look, when prices go up, consumers substitute cheaper things, so we got to fix this. So now, if the price of something goes up, they throw it out of the basket and put something cheaper in, and then they say there's no price rise.
Right.
So it no longer measures a constant standard of living. The inflation indices measure a falling standard of living.
And this also affects the deflator in the GDP.
Yeah, right. And the other thing they did, they said, well, look, not all price rises are price rises because they're quality improvements. Now, that's true, but they've pushed it to the extent that just about every price increase now becomes a quality improvement. They don't count it. Now, John Williams of Shadowstats.com, he continues to measure inflation according to the previous official methodologies, the one that tries to maintain a constant measure, you know, a constant standard of living.
Right.
And if you use those methodologies, he says the inflation rate based on the 1990 methodology is a little over 5%, and based on the 1980 methodology, which was the one when I was in the Treasury, it's over 9% annually. So, and those numbers are what anybody who regularly visits grocery stores will tell you is the case.
Right.
Or who regularly buys anything. So, I mean, everything that I buy, the price is always higher. So the numbers aren't any good. And because inflation is so greatly understated, the GDP deflator is understated. And so this is how they produce GDP growth. They take the nominal increase in GDP, and it's deflated by a make-believe number, and it leaves some real growth. If it was deflated by an accurate measure of inflation, there's been no GDP growth since the downturn in 2008. It's been negative every year.
Now, one last question on economics before we move on to some foreign policy issues. I'm just really curious how you wound up with this way of thinking. I mean, it's certainly not mainstream, and a lot of your colleagues and counterparts in government coming up, I'm sure didn't see eye to eye with you on these things.
Who were your influences? How did you wind up seeing the economy this way?
Well, you know, all you have to do is think. Now, you know, at my age and with my accomplishments, I don't want anything from them. So I don't have
right.
to apply for them. I don't have to go along with it. But if I was much younger and I was still in Washington, if I didn't want to be ostracized, I'd have to find something else to write about and not write about this, because it's part of the mythology they use to hoodwink everybody. And so it's people who are not in that system and who are not interested in benefiting from it that can afford to tell the truth. You see, most economists, at least the name ones, they get grants from corporations or the government. If they say the right things, they get invited to give speeches for nice honorariums.
Mm-hmm.
A few of the most the best operators get put on corporate boards. And if you start challenging all the bullshit, then
mm-hmm.
you lose all of those perks. So that's why I don't know how many of the people in the financial press and in the economics profession actually believe all the stuff that they tell you, or whether they just figure they ain't got any alternative.
Right.
You know, if you live in a real patriotic area where everybody puts the flag up and you criticize U.S. foreign policy, they say, oh, you're a pinko commie liberal, or you're a terrorist supporter, or and the same kind of thing happens to professionals. If they say, well, this government statistic is a lie, and they get ostracized, just like the guy whose neighbors are all waving the flag all the time would if he said, well, I don't think we should have invaded Iraq. You see what I mean?
Yep.
It works across the whole range of issues and spectrums.
Absolutely. All right, I want to touch a little bit on Iraq quickly. First of all, how did the U.S. help create the mess that is Iraq and ISIS?
Well, you see, the borders in the Middle East are artificial. They were drawn up by the French and British after World War I, when they grabbed the Middle East from the Turks. You know, it had been part of the Ottoman Empire, and the Turks fought on the German side in World War I and lost, and so the British and French seized the Middle East and made it colonies, and they drew up all these artificial boundaries, well, like the ones they made in Africa. And so what you have in these countries, and you've got the split Muslim populations. You know, the Muslims have been at each other's throats since Muhammad died, because they were fighting over who was the rightful successor and so on. And so you have the Sunnis and the Shia. They're the two biggest blocks. There are other smaller ones. But in some of these new states created by the British and French, the Sunni majority, and others, the Shia majority. And what kept them from being at each other's throats was you had authoritarian rulers like Saddam Hussein, like Assad in Syria,
mm-hmm.
Like Gaddafi, though he wasn't all that authoritarian, but he had a way about him, and he could sit on all this and suppress it. So you didn't have this mutual bloodletting. And so what did we do? We went in and destroyed the people who kept the peace. And in the process, we murdered all kinds of women and children and village elders in years of bombing and wars and depleted uranium and everything else. And the people started, their whole attitude started changing. And they became less and less willing to accept any kind of outside interference or the American puppet states that we impose. And this new group, this ISIS or ISIL, they are Muslims who've been transformed by what the West has done to the Middle East. And they're creating a new state out of parts of Syria, parts of Iraq, that would be Sunni territories. In other words, the state that's forming up would have a more natural boundary than the one the British and French left, the two that the British and French left. So, plus, their attitude toward the West has hardened, and they're unprepared to put up with the West any longer or to accept the interferences any longer, and they seem to be effective warriors, effective militarily. And it was unexpected by Washington, and it caught them off guard. But I think what it represents is just a change in the emotional and mental makeup of Muslims in the Middle East, and I don't think it can be suppressed. I think that they will prevail.
Now, with all these folks stranded up on the mountain and the fact that everything's hitting the fan, do we have a duty to go and intervene and help these people out?
Well, the question is, what can we do? Probably the best thing to do would be to go find a place for them to go, and then go to this new group and say, look, how much does it cost for you to let them go? We'll pay you the money. And that way we could at least get them out.
Right.
But somebody would have to accept them and where they're going to go. And the whole region now is in turmoil. You know, Iraq never had a chance to even come close to recovering from all the destruction the United States military dumped on the country for 8 years. And in Afghanistan, it's been going for 13 years. And Libya, of course, is now in this complete chaos because of all the warring factions that Gaddafi kept under control. There's no government in Libya. And we're seeing that there's not really a government in Iraq. And so, of course, there's none in Afghanistan. I mean, the Taliban essentially defeated us. So the question is, where would they go? We would bring them here. And then everybody would be screaming, oh, they're Muslim terrorists or something.
Right.
It's very difficult when you make the mess that we've made. So let's say we're going to go rescue them. So how many soldiers is it going to take? We certainly don't want to go in with soldiers that get defeated by ISIS. So, you know, that would be devastating to America's prestige to actually lose a pitched battle with an army.
Yeah. So
they would have to have a huge number. They have to have all kinds of bombing and missiles and blowing up, and they'd probably end up killing more people than they rescued. So I just don't know. I think the best thing to do is just would be to try to bribe the ISIS just to let these people go. They're not really a threat to ISIS, and just say, well, look, let them go. We won't have to come bomb you.
Right.
Do something. I mean, the trouble with America is, Washington, is it no longer has any diplomacy. It's so arrogant, used to just using force and threats and coercion. Do as we say, we'll bomb you in the Stone Age. This is the way. And so talking to these ISIS that way, I don't think will work. But if you go say, look, we got to figure out that these people are not slaughtered, because we can't really allow that because it hurts our reputation.
Right.
So what kind of deal can we make? I mean, that's what they should be doing.
At least try some diplomacy.
Yeah, they should be trying some diplomacy. You know, they don't know how to do it. Maybe they could hire Putin to go do it for them.
yeah, there you go. Well, speaking of Russia, we're running low on time, but I did want to touch on Russia quickly. How did we help create the situation over there?
Well, I don't know quite what you mean. You mean in the Ukraine?
Yes, Ukraine, Russia, the conflict. Did U.S. involvement in any way help create the situation in the first place?
Well, yes. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the Washington was busy at work getting as many of the former Soviet republics that were part of the Soviet Union out of Russia. And Ukraine was one of them. I mean, Ukraine had been part of Russia for centuries. But Washington took advantage of Russia's weakness when the Soviet Union collapsed, and they pried loose Ukraine, and they pried loose Georgia, and they pried loose some of the Central Asian republics that were part of the Soviet Union, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan. Those places were all Soviet socialist republics. Well, so then after they pried them out, they began trying to take them over, putting them in NATO or putting them in EU, like Ukraine's case. And this, the downside of that is, for Ukraine, is that large parts of the country, the south and the east, are former Russian provinces. They were not Ukrainian, but they were stuck into the Ukraine by various Soviet Communist Party leaders, and for different reasons, probably mainly administrative. And these are Russian people, and so this group we put in control when we organized that coup that overthrew the Ukrainian government, they are Russophobics. They're anti-Russian, and they threatened the Russian populations in word and deed, and alarmed them, and they want to leave. They want to go back to Russia, and that's the origin of all that trouble in Ukraine. You know, it would take time to go through the same situation in Georgia and in Central Asia, but it's basically the United States trying to weaken Russia so that it doesn't acquire power to be a check on our power the way the Soviet Union was.
How do you assess Obama's handling of the situation?
I would give him an F minus on everything across the board. I mean, he's failed. He's flunked out. This guy, but all of them are that way. I'd do the same for George W. Bush.
Sure.
I'd do the same for Clinton.
Well, listen, you've written that this could potentially end in nuclear war. Could you quickly walk us through a possible chain of events that could lead to that?
Yes. It's because of the Wolfowitz doctrine. It's the neoconservative doctrine that concluded with the Soviet collapse that history had chosen the United States to rule the world, because no other system worked, and the great rival system had failed, and so that leaves only our system. And since history chose us, we had the responsibility and the right to impose our way on everybody else. So this makes them very aggressive. And when Russia and China present them with rising powers, they want to block this. The doctrine says you have to prevent the rise of other powers so that they can't check your power.
Right.
Well, unless Russia and China are willing to be American puppet states like Japan and Canada and England and Germany and France, which they don't show any willingness to be, the Wolfowitz doctrine forces the United States into conflict with those countries. And since the United States has no prospect whatsoever of defeating either army on conventional terms, I mean, it couldn't even defeat the Taliban. It couldn't even occupy Iraq successfully. So the war would have to be nuclear. It's the only way the United States could. Plus, the United States has been preparing for that. First of all, they pulled out of the ABM treaty so they could develop anti-ballistic missile systems. They've made arrangements with Eastern Europe to put these anti-ballistic missile systems on Russia's border in order to degrade the Russian strategic forces And then they changed U.S. war doctrine, which had limited nuclear weapons to a retaliatory role that would only be used if the United States suffered a nuclear attack. Well, they changed that and made nuclear weapons a first strike force. So in the American war doctrine for the last few years, it says that the United States regards nuclear weapons as a preemptive first strike force. So what does that tell the Russians? Well, this is all directed at them. And then they watch this interference essentially in their own land in the Ukraine, and the constant lies and the constant setting them up, the constant demonization, the constant calls from these NATO generals for more military buildup on Russia's borders, preparation for blitzkrieg attacks on Russia, all of this, and they say, well, these people are preparing for war. And so this makes them antsy and jumpy. And the Chinese are suffering the same thing. So when you, as I said, it's reckless and irresponsible for a political leader like Obama to convince the Russians and Chinese that he's going to nuke them. But that's what he's done. He's convinced them of that. And so people who are convinced of that, you don't know how they're going to behave. They may wait for, you know, trying to avoid it and waiting for more and more signs and letting it get closer. Or they may decide, look, we got to take matters in our own hands. These people are crazy.
Sure.
And so you just don't know. So that's the easiest way to understand the position that I've spelled out. And it's really driven by this neoconservative doctrine of U.S. world hegemony, that we chosen by history to rule the world.
Well, certainly is a scary situation. And look, we're just about out of time, Dr. Roberts, but as we wrap up here, could you tell the listeners the best place for folks to follow you?
Well, my website is just my name, www.paulcraigroberts.org, and they can find all the latest postings there and the various guest columns I have from other people. We don't have an agenda except to tell the truth as we're able to discover it. I mean, we may be wrong sometimes, but we don't. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not for or against any particular political agenda. I'm just for the truth. And my experience in life is that politicians are extremely unreliable.
Well, we love you for that, and we're going to link up to your site up on our website. And thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Roberts. I really did enjoy it, and hope we can do it again sometime.
Sure we can. I appreciate your interest.
All right, everybody, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed our chat with Paul Craig Roberts. We have a link to his site up on the website. And again, take a look at his articles, watch some of the interviews he gives. I love hearing his take on the economy and geopolitical events as they unfold. He provides really unique insight, and he's usually right on the money. Coming up on the show, we'll be talking with Tom DiLorenzo, author of The Real Lincoln, and we're working on David Stockman, another Reagan guy, so stay tuned for updates on that. Also, remember, if you like the show, please subscribe on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at @PolyBadger. That's P-O-L-Y Badger. Thanks again, you guys. We'll catch you next time. Take care. Peace.